Welcome to Nevada Newsmakers. On the broadcast today, we talk with Robert Lang, director of the Lindsay Institute. We're talking homelessness, transportation, and manufacturing. It's all coming up next on an all-new Nevada Newsmakers.
Nevada Newsmakers is brought to you in part by the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center, Pro Group Management, and the Retail Association of Nevada.
Hi, my name's Marilyn Miner, and I'm sure you'd agree that Nevada's a very special place to live. I was born here, and my husband and I have raised our family here. I feel it's a privilege to live and work in the Truckee Meadows. I especially enjoy helping my clients reach their real estate goals. Sometimes the smallest details provide the greatest satisfaction. I'd be complimented to talk to you about your next move.
Call Marilyn Miner at Dixon Realty, 742-1280, or log on to marilynminer.com.
The signs and symptoms of cataracts can start out small with subtle changes in your vision. So don't wait. Be proactive and take your vision into your own hands. If you're experiencing the onset of cataracts or just have questions, contact your eye care professional or call Eye Care Associates of Nevada today. Dr. Hiss has years of experience specializing in the surgical correction of eye disorders and has completed over 84,000 vision-correcting procedures. At Eye Care Associates of Nevada, we'll change the way you look at the world.
This is Nevada Newsmakers with host Sam Chan, a no-holds-barred political forum. Now, from the Nevada Newsmakers broadcast headquarters, here is Sam Chan.
And back on Nevada Newsmakers, we're delighted to welcome back to the program Robert Lang. He is the director of the Lindsay Institute and director of Brookings Mountain West. Pleasure to have you back on the program, sir.
Thanks for having me.
So, with the boom going on at both ends of the state, which is really quite remarkable if you look at any of the 50 states to see something like this going on, it seems to me that at the top of the list of problems we need to deal with, one is homelessness, the other is transportation. And let's start with homelessness first, because I know that the Las Vegas City Council has been taking a serious look at this and is putting together a 24-hour-a-day campus down there by Formaster Lane and Las Vegas Boulevard. In Reno, we have redevelopment that's going on in the downtown area that is taking out a lot of these rundown motels, these weekly rentals. And it's, even though that part of it is good because it's going to clean up that portion of the city, it's bad in the fact that you now have 250 units that are no longer available to the poorest people to be able to rent. How do you view this?
It's a problem in Nevada. It's one of the states with the least affordable housing. There was a piece in the Review Journal today on that very subject. It's just, we've never built that much affordable housing. That's true going back to the beginning of the affordable housing programs. We built some public housing in Las Vegas, but by and large, there's never been a concern for affordable housing. The strategy has been instead, go through a boom, get to a bust, and then the downward filtered housing would be affordable to people who in the boom couldn't buy it, which is hardly an affordable housing strategy.
Now, if you go to a major city in New York or London, then you have these projects, Chicago, where they build these tower blocks, and those are the county's housing or the city's housing for the poor. Do you ever envision something like that happening in low-tax Nevada?
No, but it may be something like Phoenix. So Phoenix is not that different than a Vegas, and Phoenix has had a history of building low-density, sort of, you know, cluster department structures that are not the Pruitt-Igoes of St. Louis and not the sort of Scudder homes at Newark, the legendary housing that, you know, is so associated with, you know, cities that are in distress. So there's a kind of Southwest style of doing this, and what it means is you build these kinds of garden apartments, and again, it just took, you know, will on those parts of those cities to do it. There's been federal programs for years that induces private investment through low-income housing tax credits where you could do these projects. But when I came to Nevada, one of the interesting things is how few of those had been in the works, how few of those had been done. And, you know, I date myself here. I go back to Fannie Mae in the 1990s. And that sounds like I work for Enron now. But, you know, it was good Fannie back then. And I worked in Fannie and went to these different regions on these partnership offices. And what was always interesting to me was how little activity was going on in the Nevada partnership office as far as specific housing targeted to low-income households. And so what you get as a result is you have a higher homeless population. It's also a warmer climate. there's a, you know, also a history of Nevada having, you know, folks come and go, or, you know, some stay, some don't. And so there's been a kind of accumulation of this over the years. And now that we're booming, and both Reno and Las Vegas are booming, you're going to see some people displaced because, you know, housing that was once not so desirable in downtown Reno or downtown Las Vegas that people occupied who had little means to, you know, afford rents elsewhere are going to be pushed out.
And, you know, for Reno, we're looking at the surrounding areas. You know, the center of gravity caused by the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center has shifted sort of the center of the region from Reno Sparks a little bit further east. So that Tahoe Reno Industrial Center is now the center. And you have Reno Sparks on the periphery. Then you have Fernley, Fallon, Yerington, the US 50 corridor. So those are places where land is cheap, land is available, and you could see lower income housing there. You are seeing lower income housing there, but not for the poorest of people. But, you know, is that a solution when you don't have bus service to get to a place like that?
It would be workforce housing. So in some cases, some of the workers in the lower ends of these employment areas would, and who had less wage, you know, had less wages, would seek out housing, you know, that was not the single-family detached, you know, higher-end master plan stuff that you see going up in the high-end neighborhoods in Reno. That's different than housing for people who are homeless that are the poorest of the poor. What you have with homeless and what you have with people who have less than, let's say, half the area median income is you have just this acute need that either you build shelters and you have a strategy like Las Vegas is attempting to do, or you have lots of people on the street. Those are your choices. Either you attempt a remedy, and the remedy includes shelter, or you're going to see a lot of people, you know, homeless. There's a whole different sort of dynamic that goes on when you get to people who are approaching the median area income because they're working in some of these industries. You're right, the whole gravity of the region up there has moved east out to the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center because it's been so successful that all that land between, you know, Sparks and Reno all the way east might have low housing, might have low cost now, but as that begins to fill in, as a city emerges on the east side of Reno, which is where a lot of the growth is going to be, you're going to see prices bid up on that land, and then it's going to have to be reflected in the housing costs. So you have to plan in advance. When you're doing workforce housing, if you look at the research triangle in North Carolina, you look at some of the other high-tech belts that have been effective at doing planning around affordable housing, Austin, you have to figure out where that's going to go, and it's not an afterthought. So the lesson for Reno is, you know, looking at the Austins or looking at Raleigh, North Carolina, and Chapel Hill, figure out what commitment you're going to make, where that's going to go for workforce, and come up with a plan for homelessness.
The other conundrum is that the more you take care of the homeless and the poor, the more of a magnet you become for the homeless and the poor from other areas coming to the region because they understand that there are now services and shelter available.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's less of a concern than people suspect, that, you know, the majority of people who you end up querying about their homeless situation, if you look at their origins, a very large percentage are from the region itself. So some people do, and, you know, there's always going to be some of that, but what do you do? There's a trade-off here. Do you deny services to people who've just fallen on hard times and have been in your region historically, have been there their whole life or maybe multi-generations? Because you worry that some Californian's going to catch wind of it. You know, to the Californians, they think they provide such high service that they're seeing a lot of Nevadans show up. But, you know, we had the whole scandal involving mental health services, as you'll recall, not too long ago, where we were giving bus tickets to Sacramento. So that's a kind of national problem, which is why it would be good if the federal government were more engaged in some of these issues, because it would equalize the amount of commitment and the amount of risk that regions were taking throughout the country, because we're such a mobile population that there's always the possibility of that.
Yeah, and it would be nice to see HUD more engaged, but I don't think that's likely for the next couple of years. You know what was shocking, Rob, was my wife and I were staying in Berkeley, and we wanted to go over to Jack London Square in Oakland. And that drive takes you past these homeless encampments that are huge. I mean, they are huge. And it's so shocking in an area where there is so much money and the cost of housing is so high to see almost India-like proportions of poverty.
Yeah, that's the tale of two Californias there. I mean, you know, you're in one of the most affluent metros in the entire world, in San Francisco, one of the most successful. And then the downside of it is that anybody who's not part of that economy is, you know, at risk for being displaced completely by, you know, being priced out of any market that's reasonable. Like something like Oakland used to be, as you know, an affordable housing opportunity. And that part of downtown Oakland in particular had a lot of single room occupancy buildings and so on. That's all fancy now. Oakland isn't Oakland anymore in the way that people in the, you know, the popular mind in the Bay Area think of Oakland. It's not San Jose, it's not Berkeley, but it's certainly seen a lot of spillover from people who said, I really can't afford to live in San Jose or San Francisco or Berkeley or Marin, forget Marin. You know, my options to stay in this region to work in technology are in Oakland, and they've bid up the prices.
All right, let's take a break. More with Robert Lang when we come back.
Nearly 200,000 Nevadans work in retail businesses, supporting families and the community. Nevada's retail businesses generated over $2 billion in sales tax revenue in 1 year, including nearly $700 million to help our schools. Shop around and see all that Nevada's retailers offer our state.
We're the Retail Association of Nevada, representing thousands of Nevada businesses.
Businesses that work for Nevada.
ProGroup Management specializes in providing industries with the necessary components to satisfy and exceed workers' comp requirements. Every business has unique needs and specific regulations. ProGroup Management stays ahead of the curve, providing up-to-date services to keep your industry in top form. Discover how we simplify your tasks, improve efficiency, and reduce expense to keep you moving in a positive direction. ProGroup Management. Workers' comp that works for you.
This is Nevada Newsmakers.
And back on Nevada Newsmakers, we continue our conversation with Robert Lang. He's the director of the Lindsay Institute and director of Brookings Mountain West in Las Vegas. Let's talk about transportation, and especially in Southern Nevada, where it seems to me that, you know, something has to be done, and very soon. I had John Ensminger on the program a couple of weeks ago with the Southern Nevada Water Authority, and their 50-year plan now puts the population of Las Vegas Valley at 3.5 million people. 3.5 million people versus almost 2 million people now. And yet, you know, is the expansion of the monorail an answer? Is light rail the answer? And are these things going to either be funded or brought to fruition?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, you know, the figures you can look at if you just want it in graphic terms. So Las Vegas Valley, you know, the Clark County right now is at 2.25 million. It'll come out in the next census estimate at around that exact number. To put it in perspective, Las Vegas is adding a Carson City a year. It's almost 50,000 people per year. And if it does that over 10 years, it's 500,000 people. So Las Vegas, in my numbers, in the numbers that I use from Woods and Poole, which is a consulting firm in Washington, D.C., and does projections, gets to the 3.5 figure before 50 years from now. It gets to it by mid-21st century. In fact, it could get to 4 million, depending on how growth goes. So, yeah, there's an acute need for transportation solutions, especially that Las Vegas's tourist economy adds many more people. So you could add the equivalent of the city of Pittsburgh on top of that on any weekend. So it's March Madness is coming up. And this city is going to be, you know, active because of sportsbook over the next few days as March Madness gets underway. And you're looking at several hundred thousand people showing up in the city. And they, you know, in many other places expect a transportation system that would reflect that kind of activity. And what you find here is little in the way of that development. You know, the monorail was built behind the hotels. It went from nowhere to nowhere. It ended in two odd terminuses. It didn't make it to the airport for reasons we don't have time to discuss in this show, but are, you know, some of them were, concerns about, competition with taxis. So at this point, what we need is we need to do light rail, probably a line up Maryland Parkway to downtown and a line that extends out to this massive new stadium that we're building that's near, and this is the kicker, that stadium on Russell is not far from the most important intersection of all of Nevada, is Las Vegas Boulevard and Tropicana.
Right.
And if you don't fix that intersection by, and you can't add any more capacity, it's at like 15, 18 lanes, some crazy, it's like the New Jersey Turnpike, only it's on the surface. You know, it's like the 405 in L.A., only it's on the surface. If you, we're out of space. There's no more rights away. If you don't add capacity to that by including alternative transit, where you can pack people into a train and slide them through the middle of that without everybody being wrapped in a car. When people are wrapped in a car, they take an inordinate amount of space on a roadway. But when they're in a train, one of the efficiencies is if you're sitting in a fairly densely packed train on a way to a football stadium from an airport, the good news, and everybody else seems to know this, Denver knows this, Salt Lake knows this, Phoenix knows this, is that you're really not in the way of traffic. You're really a solution to it. So I think we'll get it done. I just think there's been a history of resistance in Southern Nevada. We've had the enabling legislation go through, so we are authorized to do this. We just have to find the will to do it and the resources to do it. My sense is that the stadium will probably be the tipping point, and we'll end up doing it.
And so that second line beyond the Maryland one would be from the airport to the Raiders Stadium?
And up Las Vegas Boulevard through the corridor. Because what it is the fortune of Las Vegas is this. We have a very close-in airport. I mean, look, you know, you take a case of Denver. They built their airport, the new airport, you know, when they replaced right. Stapleton. And they built Denver International. They built it at like the Kansas state line, practically.
It's 25 miles.
Meanwhile, yeah. They've got a train going to it.
Yes.
Yeah. So somebody else in these other places, you know, so, you know, even in the case of where you have 20-plus miles distance from the downtown back to the airport in Denver, they found a way to get the resources to not – they couldn't even do light rail. They had to do a regional rail to it, a really fast diesel train, practically, or a high-end electric train out to this thing because – there's that much distance it has to cover, whereas we can throw a rock from the airport and practically hit Mandalay Bay.
Right.
And you can actually see the strip. The frustration to somebody who arrives at Las Vegas' airport is that when they get on a taxi cab line or they wait for an Uber, they literally can see in the distance the buildings. Now, if it's a slow day, jump in a cab. But if it's the Electric Daisy Carnival or it's the Consumer Electronics Show or it's in one of these places, one of these weekends where, you know, like March Madness, where, you know, every you know, college grad from the last 10 years is showing up in the city and wants to bet on their team, you're going to need alternative transportation. And when the Raiders come, when they're the Las Vegas Raiders, which is coming very soon, and you have those epic weekends, we're looking at a Super Bowl. We're, you know, we've done a debate down here. You know we're going to get a political convention sooner or later. We have the largest events economy in the United States, and we have very close proximity of the structures that are engaged in this economy. In other words, we have a really tight tourist zone. It's only 4 miles long and about a mile wide, and yet all those advantages that would be provided for transit through that zone with a most dense space with the most people that's not using transit right now in the United States, maybe in the world.
All right, let's take a break. More with Robert Lang when we come back.
Nevada Newsmakers is brought to you in part by the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center, Pro Group Management, and the Retail Association of Nevada.
I'm Paul Enos, CEO of the Nevada Trucking Association. Truck drivers are some of the hardest working people you'll meet, delivering over 70% of America's freight and 92% of Nevada's. When there's a natural disaster, they're delivering critical supplies to help those communities recover and rebuild. Every sector of the economy and our nation's military rely on truck drivers. So let's take a moment to say thank you. On the open road or city streets, our truck drivers are rolling to make our economy and our nation stronger. Trucking moves America forward.
How do you shed some light on a better economy? Start with growth inspired by Valley Electric Association. We're a member-owned power company that puts Nevada first, and we're doing big things, like providing prosperity by securing renewable energy projects. For Nevada, that means more jobs and more opportunities, all for a strong statewide economy. In other words, together, we're doing powerful things. Visit us at vea.coop to learn more.
And now, back to Nevada Newsmakers with Sam Shad.
And back on Nevada Newsmakers, we continue our conversation with Robert Lang. He's the director of the Lindsay Institute and a director of Brookings Mountain West. Let's talk about manufacturing. And Apex in particular. I spent some time in Las Vegas recently and did interviews down there concerning manufacturing. It seems to be a lot of interest from various forms of manufacturing to come to Southern Nevada. But my question is, the difference between the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center and Apex is that the single owner of the Tahoe Reno Industrial Center put in $100 million worth of infrastructure. So the roads were there, the fiber was there, the sewer was there, the power was there, on and on and on. And so when people came to the park, they were given a grading permit pretty much the first day, and then they could progress and progress very rapidly. With Apex, you know, is it the state's responsibility or North Las Vegas's responsibility or the owner's responsibility to put in that infrastructure to make manufacturing a reality?
I mean, every one of them, in that, you know, even the Tahoe Reno Center up there had the road built down to Carson City. That was a state project. So the state's responsible for making sure that major commuter sheds have linkages to major employment centers. And that's a legitimate role of the public investment in transportation throughout the country. And I could show you that in every state I've ever been in, Virginia and New Jersey, that that's a policy. In other words, if you have a Tysons Corner, Virginia, which is a big cluster of office space, then you need the state to step in and to provide some of the resource because it's really in the public good. And so Tahoe Reno was in the public good to make that investment that enhanced its commuter shed because it's a reliever to go south down that road, that Parkway USA, I think it's called.
USA Parkway, yeah.
Same thing's true in North Las Vegas, but you're right. The barrier of entry was lower in Tahoe Reno because it had a single investor, a single owner, single management, and that they had put basic infrastructure in, and they could green light projects the day of, and that made it very attractive to companies like Tesla. The North Las Vegas attempted through the mayor's office to create a proxy of that. In fact, they actually went and took the trouble of looking at the permitting process in Story County and tried to make North Las Vegas the equivalent of Story County. Now, you know, famously, of course, they went after an electric car manufacturer that didn't work out. It was always a risk. That thing, that car manufacturer, helped tremendously in that it graded and spent a fortune on a lot that is now primed. That you talk about ready to build, you could go vertical almost overnight on the lot that was left from Faraday. And that Faraday required a resolution finally of water supply and of rail and especially road hookups, because some of the northern parts of the Beltway that would have been the feeder highway for some of the commuting into you know, Apex just were incomplete. And that is part of what's on NDOT's books now. So the fact that, you know, the state steps in, I mean, the governor is always ready. If the governor sees an opportunity to build out some manufacturing capacity in Nevada, he has been aggressive and proactive, and his administration has been on the mark getting that done. So all of this came together, you know, in the case of Apex for Faraday. Even though Faraday didn't work out, none of that is lost because the next manufacturer that chooses that site has the advantage of having cleared all the hurdles that Apex had to go through, including the fact Apex spent $100 million on the site. It never received a nickel in compensation by the state by way of tax relief, and yet there it sits, ready to build on.
Well, and bless them and bless the governor and Steve Hill for making sure that that contract worked that way. Sadly, we are out of time. It is always a pleasure to have you on the program, Robert. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll be right back.
Sully's Sports Bar inside the Tamarack Junction is South Reno's headquarters for locals to watch all your favorite sports. And now you can enjoy your favorite team on our brand new high-def TVs featuring the Papa, the big daddy of them all. It's our giant 17-foot big screen TV wall. And we have two 79-inch high-def TVs, 12 65-inch high-def TVs, including two party booths for your own private party, and six high-def private booth TVs. Bring in your own headphones and listen to your favorite game right from your own seat. First, make your bets in our William Hill Sportsbook, then enjoy your favorite cold beer, libations, burgers, wings, pizza, and our signature Build Your Own Bloody Mary bar. Then settle in and download our app and listen to any game being shown in Sully's Sports Bar. Catch your favorite team on our new high-def big screen TVs. Sully's Sports Bar is the only place to watch your favorite sports all year long. The Tamarack Junction, just north of the Summit Mall in South Virginia.
It's Tamarack Junction, your junction for fun.
St. Ives Florist, for every holiday and every special occasion. For romance. Custom home design. We have the largest selection of fresh flowers in northern Nevada. And we also offer a large selection of unique gift items. Come see me, Lori Ann, at St. Ives Florist, 700 South Wells Avenue, or call me at 333-9190.
Among the guests next week, former Congressman Joe Heck. We'll see you then.